doing it for the first time in the meeting, and I hope the honourable members will allow that to happen. Can we then rise and just give in? Thank you very much. We can be seated. The agenda is in front of all of us, honorable members, and everybody that is inside here, I think, has got the agenda with him or her. The agenda will be distributed. The ladies there at the back are trying to distribute the agenda. Can you be quick, ladies, so that when the meeting is starting, everybody has got their agenda? Obviously, the agenda has a welcoming and an opening agenda item. Let me welcome everybody in this meeting. Honorable members, you are being welcome, and I know this meeting took you out of your constituency period, but because of our resolutions that we have taken on the 21st of June, and saying we are going to have this meeting before we start with the inquiry itself. The AUCCHA, or the South African Council of Churches, is welcome. They are part of us. The AUCCHA is also part of us. We welcome you. And also the research project that is also going to give us a briefing on the betrayal of the promise. They are with us also, so I welcome them. I welcome the media in this meeting, and I welcome everybody, even if there are people that are coming from outside Parliament who are not members of Parliament, I welcome them. But I want to be consistent on what we are doing. I have asked people who are not members of Parliament, to be not inside the chamber, but on the gallery. I don't want to do something that is going to haunt us back, is going to kick back to us as members of Parliament. We know when we are seated, we have the media. They know where they usually sit when there is a committee meeting. But members of Parliament must be identified as members of Parliament. I don't know every member from other organizations. I don't want to point a person who is not a member of Parliament, point him to speak in the meeting of the committee, because this meeting is a committee meeting, not an organizational meeting or a meeting of a public meeting. Like, it is publicly, but it is not a public meeting where everybody is allowed to speak. Relevant people will be speaking. Members will be speaking. The three presentations will be coming from the three groups of people. They will be speaking, and we will interact with them. So please, I don't want this to come back to me. I would not have answers for it. Thank you very much. I hope that is understood and that is taken with a warm heart. The second item of the agenda is apologies. Can we have apologies?
Thank you, Chairperson. The apology we've received is from Mr. Kwankwa, who will only be joining us around 12 o'clock. He's got prior engagement. Mr. Mazone is not in the country, will be represented by Mr. Mainir from the DA, and also an apology for Mr. Mare, who is a DA member of the committee. We've also got Mr. Floyd Chibambu, who will be representing the EFF in the committee. And then we've also got Mr. Swartz, who is here as a member of the committee.
Thank you very much. Apologies accepted. Members, let's concentrate, please. Honorable Singh.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, everybody. Maybe it'll be helpful if we can just get introductions from those people that are in here so we know who's who in here and they know who we are.
We will. Accepted there because they are written apologies as per the committee resolution. Can we then do the introductions? Because I don't think we know each other. We've got new people with us in the committee for the first time. We will start by introducing the members, and then after the members, our visitors will introduce themselves, and the staff, and everybody who is inside here will introduce themselves. The media houses will also introduce themselves so that we know who is here. Thank you very much. My name is Zuki Swaranto. I'm the acting chairperson of this committee. Thank you. Mainir.
My name is David Mania. I'm representing Natasha Mazone in this committee for just this meeting. She will be back for the inquiry itself. And thank you, Chair, for your warm welcome. I certainly feel more welcome at this committee than the Finance Committee.
Chair, Robin Gordon, ANC.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Moss Tilly. I'm a member of the Portfolio Committee.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Mwandli Kungubele, a member of the committee.
Morning, Chair. I'm Zukile Luyenge. I'm a member of this committee.
Yeah, my name is Floyd Chibambu. I'm from the Economic Freedom Fighters.
Good morning. My name is Naren Singh, a member of this Public Enterprises Committee.
Okay. Morning, Chair. Thank you for your welcome. I'm Steve Swart from the ACD. Thank you so much.
Morning, Chair. Sorry for being late. My name is Gerin Obanda, member of the committee.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Malusi Mbumrana from the South African Council of Churches.
Morning, Chair. My name is Hedy van Vieren from Open Secrets.
Morning, Chair. My name is Ati from SACC.
Morning, Chair. My name is Ivan Chipkin from the Public Affairs Research Institute, representing the State Capacity Research Group.
Morning, Chair. I'm Ted Blom. I'm the Energy Director at ALTA.
Morning, Chair and Honourable Members. My name is Rudy Heineke from ALTA.
Good morning, Chair, and good morning, Honourable Members. My name is Dominique Msebi, and I am from ALTA.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Fuzo Zenzile from DPE.
Yes, to give it from ENCA.
So they're just visitors. They're just visitors.
We can't hear you, ma'am. Can you speak to the mic, please?
Maria Merton, Daily Maverick.
I'm Gay Davis from Eyewitness News.
Good morning. I'm Loretta Lawrence, PA to the chairperson.
Legal Papers and 24.
Linda Insel, Business Day.
Princeton DA Research.
Siyabonga Mkhonazi, Independent Media.
Good morning, Chair. Llewellyn Prince of Network 24.
Good morning. It's Jane Rothsmith from the Parliamentary Monitoring Group.
Oh, good morning. I'm Yi from Parliamentary Monitoring Group as well.
Baba Londenze from the Sunday Times.
Chile Sora, Citizen Media, South Africa.
Good morning, I'm Tabang from Parliament's Legal Services.
Good morning, I'm Fatima Brown, Parliamentary Legal Advisor.
Suan Isaac, Parliamentary Legal Advisor.
Good morning, Chair Anthony Mitchell, IFP Legal.
Thank you very much. We are being joined by other people, and which I think we need to know them. I'm sorry for not giving you enough time to speak, but you can introduce yourself, sir. And the lady behind or at the back.
The chairperson of the SECC in the Western Cape.
Good morning, Basitana Pora from ANN7. Basitana Pora.
Reverend.
There are members who did not hear your name, sir.
Yes, Reverend Peter Grove.
Thank you, honorable members, for the introduction, and thank you for our visitors for introducing themselves. I want to take us to the background of what we are trying to do as this committee. The committee on the 23rd of May 2017 took a decision that they would apply for an inquiry on Eskom. On Eskom reappointment of Brian Molefe and the governance as a whole in Eskom. That's the decision we took on the 23rd. After a meeting that we had on the same day with Eskom board and the minister, or the ministry itself, the minister and the deputy minister were part of that meeting. After our deliberations and our interaction with both the minister and the board of Eskom, the committee felt there are underlying issues that were not presented to us by Eskom and the ministry. Therefore, we took a decision on that day that for us to get deeper to what we are looking for, we must have an inquiry towards Eskom. So we took that decision. Then on the 21st of June 2017, we considered terms of reference, list of potential witnesses and documents that we think are necessary for us to request from Eskom. We also agreed that we will have a meeting, not this meeting, that is not on at the beginning of the term because we are on recess and on constituency period. We agreed as a committee that we will have meetings on ungodly hours and also ungodly days, maybe, if there are ungodly days. Only godly days, ne? Yeah, all days are godly days. So we took that decision. For the process and the preparation of this meeting and the other meetings that will follow and the inquiry, I have been interacting with the staff on a regular basis. We have prepared and circulated some documents to members. Eskom has also submitted some documents, and the documents are shared with all members. When we look at the documents that are in front of us, we saw that this is not a straightforward process. It is very complex for us because we are doing it for the first time as a committee of public enterprises. It needs extensive and very, it's very extensive and it's very technical.
Therefore, we needed more time and more information. Hence, as the chairperson of, or the acting chairperson of this portfolio committee, I realize it is important for us to engage with experts and organizations that have done some research and investigations on state capture phenomenon. I asked enough time to the committee. In fact, we took a decision that we need enough time to do this, because looking at the extensivity of and the sensitivity of the issues, we thought we do not want to do this as a by the way issue. We need to get, we know the information is outside there, but we think we need to be very, very extensive in doing our inquiry. We don't want to leave any stone unturned. Therefore, that is why we start by having these meetings. This might be the first meeting, but it might not be the last meeting, because there is more information that is coming out, and it's not new information. It's information that has been there, but there are information now that is coming out that needs us to raise our eyebrows more and more on the inquiry itself, not to take it very light. I also want to thank the political parties in this committee to allow me to meet every relevant person, and they allow me to make more research on the issues. I want to thank them for their understanding. I know we have different political ideologies, but they did understand that we need to do this together to save our country, and also to make sure that our government is accountable to this committee, and to actually show the whole South Africa or the whole world that the mandate that we are given as a committee or as public representative, we are working on our mandate. We have not left our mandate behind and work for something else. I also think it is proper for me to put the proposals of the committee before we start the meeting. We asked from Parliament to give us more researchers, more legal people to help us in doing this inquiry or preparing for the inquiry. We also wrote to the Chair of Chairs last week to request a service of Advocate Vanara. Advocate Vanara is no more on the legal services of Parliament, but he is here in Parliament. We wanted to source the experience that he had with the Committee of Communications or the Ad Hoc Committee of Communication. And also we would like him to have enough time to prepare for the inquiry, because we want him to lead the inquiry, to be an evidence leader in the inquiry and help us as members. So he must interact with all the documentation that we have and also check the relevance of the potential witnesses. We don't want to call a person here who is going to take us out of what we are looking for or out of our objective. We want every person to focus on the objectives of the committee. We wrote to ESCOM also to inform them of the inquiry, but we did not write to individual potential witnesses in saying, on this date, you will be coming in front of the committee. We want to gather as much information as possible, then we carry on with the inquiry without any disturbances and also without any hiccups that will come out. So on the 1st of August, we will not go to start the inquiry, because we are still looking into what we have and we want to acquaint ourselves with the information that is in front of us. Information that we get from the media, the information that is out there, we want to gather all that information and be prepared for the inquiry as much as possible. We are going to start our meeting. That was just an opening remark, a short opening remark from me as the chairperson of the committee. Honorable Singh.
Yeah, Chairperson, thank you for that information. We could probably have a discussion on what you've said later in the after when we've done with the presentations.
Yes, we will. We have a document also in front of us as members of Parliament, Eskom project map that we have, we'll need to discuss later as a committee. Thank you very much, Honorable Singh. I think now it is time for us to get to the third item or the fourth item of the agenda, which is the briefing by the South African Council of Churches on the findings of the unburdening report. We will give over to Reverend Bumlwana. He will be maybe the one who's going to present, or he will give over to the person who's going to present the document to us. Thank you very much, Mr. Bumlwana. Reverend Bumlwana.
Thank you, ma'am. Honorable Ranto, Acting Chairperson, Portfolio Committee on Public Enterprises, Honorable Members of the Portfolio Committee, all greetings. I thank you, Honorable Ranto, for your invitation to us to come and share our perspectives with this Commission on such critical matters as are on the table. I expect that members of the Portfolio Committee will be indicating the areas of their interest in which we could be of any assistance. My statement will hopefully be fairly short, certainly not more than 30 minutes, so that there is adequate time for members of the Portfolio Committee to raise whatever questions they may have for us. In my remarks, I propose to give some background to what the SACC Unburdening Report, what became the SACC Unburdening Report, beginning with why it became necessary as the SSCC's pastoral approach in the special circumstances that prevailed. Secondly, I shall give a summary of our observations and then pronounce on them from the perspective of public ethics. However, Madam Chair, I beg your indulgence to first speak to a very small matter that has been raised by some in relation to why the churches have the temerity to pronounce on matters that are considered political. The standard refrain has been that church leaders should restrict their focus on spiritual matters and stay clear of political pronouncements. It seems appropriate that we should, within these hallowed walls of our legislature, make it clear once and for all that those who make such calls on churches are either genuinely ignorant of the nature of the Christian faith, or are simply being disingenuous. While we suspect that the latter might be the case, we consider it worthwhile providing for those who may be genuinely ignorant. First, we should remind people that the preamble of our national constitution ends by saying, "May God protect our people." This is indeed the constitutional imperative for the church to rise to protect the people of South Africa in the name of God. For, as St. Paul writes, we are ambassadors for Christ, God making his appeal through us. The call for the churches, and the SACC in particular, to confine itself to the sanctuary was a favored chorus of the apartheid leaders, John Balthazar Foster, Peter Willembotha, and them, when the SACC was standing firm in defense of the defenseless, trampled by the apartheid jackboot. When the SACC, in partnership with its global body, the World Council of Churches, unapologetically supported the liberation movements, materially and politically, through the theological justification of the liberation struggle. We never dreamt in our wildest dreams that there would come a time in democratic South Africa when political leaders take on the four-step water chorus, churches to the altars and pulpits, and leave politics to politicians. Our response to this will simply be a direct quote from one of my illustrious predecessors as General Secretary of the South African Council of Churches, when he had to defend the ministry of the SACC to a special judicial commission, the ILOF Commission of Inquiry into the South African Council of Churches. In a submission titled The Divine Intention, General Secretary Desmond Tutu said, "Our religion is concerned about the here and now, because that determines, to a large extent, the hereafter. Time, in Hebrew Christian understanding, has eternal significance, and that is why human lives and human decisions are important. All life belongs to God. The Christian faith believes that God uses ordinary material things as vehicles for God's special grace and divine life, as in the sacraments. Our religion is incarnational through and through. The whole of life is important, political, economic, and social. And none of these aspects is untouched by religion as we understand it." Tutu continues. "It is part of God's mission and purpose for his word to bring about wholeness, justice, good health, righteousness, peace, and harmony and reconciliation. These are what belong to the kingdom of God, and we are his agents to work with him as his partners to bring to pass all that God wants for his universe. He showed himself as a liberator God. Where there is injustice, exploitation, and oppression, then the Bible and the God of the Bible are subversive of such a situation." Close quote. It is our hope that these vintage words of the vintage SACC to an apartheid judge who surely must fit the epithet counter-revolutionary will suffice to clarify that the SACC never did in the past, cannot today, and will not in the future refuse to address national issues in relation to public ethics, be it the unethical apartheid regime or the unethical corruption, greed, or the usurpation of state institutions for private benefit and against the public good. For this reason, the SACC National Conference has resolved to collaborate with South African society through a national convention process that will agree on the basic standards and values against which public institutions and public officials will be measured in the critical spheres of our life and agree on what is ethically un-South African. Honorable Ranto, in your letter of invitation, you requested that we come and make a presentation on our findings in the light of our unburdening report. First, the background as to the unburdening panel process. In April 2016, the SACC created the unburdening panel as a safe space and a facility offered by the churches to any person in the Republic of South Africa who may wish to relieve herself or himself of the burden caused by an experience of someone, an individual, a representative of business interest, of a political party, or of a person of influence, your superior, someone you couldn't say no to, suggesting that you do something inappropriate in return for a promotion, an attractive position, or money, or shares in a company, or any other favor or incentive whatsoever. This was essentially a pastoral process for the people and not an investigation. As the word says, it is a provision for people to unburden themselves and tell what they wish to tell freely. The unburdening notion is based on the Bible text that says, "Bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ." This comes out of Paul's writing to the Galatian church. The panel is chaired by the SACC president, Bishop Zipo Siwa. Other members of the panel are Madam Yvonne Mokoro, retired Justice of the Constitutional Court, Dr. Brigelia Bam, a previous General Secretary of the SACC, and a former chair of the Independent Electoral Commission, and Bishop Musa Sono, presiding Bishop of Grace Bible Church in the Evangelical Alliance of South Africa. Working with a team of voluntary lawyers and researchers for the public good and with the General Secretary of the SACC coordinating the Secretariat. Depending on the wishes of the unburdening persons, their information would be utilized by the churches for advocacy in the anchoring democracy pillar of the South Africa We Pray For campaign, or be made public for South Africans to know what is going on, as is appropriate, be given to a constitutional body like the Human Rights Commission or the Public Protector or any organization identified by the person concerned. The process was simply to hear the people from people who had either been pressured to participate in corrupt wrongdoing or had witnessed such. Some came forward only to share their experiences with no desire to be publicly revealed. And this is by and far the large majority, but to only clear their chests. Others were ready to go public, and these were encouraged to go to the Public Protector, and they did. Their stories are now before the nation in the state of capture report that has yet to be acted upon by the government. It must be clear that although of moment was the immediate patterns of orchestrated wrongdoing which triggered the creation of the unburdening process, we declared at the time of its creation that, and I quote from that statement, it is also understood that there are many cases of corrupt practices that impact on people, that are a rollover from improper opportunities of apartheid days. As these impacts in the democratic period, they will be entertained. We have yet to receive any person who has information of the pre-1994 era and even the shenanigans of the transition period. We have, however, been intrigued, and it's a joy to have Henny van Vuren in the room, who has recently published the book Apartheid Guns and Money. That makes very interesting reading. I was telling him that I buy it to make gifts because I think it makes very good reading. There is a lot of attention being focused on the disturbing revelations of national level goings on, with the daily colorful emails to fuel public interest. But in fact, we know that there is much that is happening at the local and provincial levels. Indeed, we encountered cases of people at municipal and provincial level who were pressured to divert public funds inappropriately to certain activities that had nothing to do with the work and purpose of the budget. There were people who were prevailed upon to rig tender processes in favor of certain companies and individuals, or bend and tailor regulations for a specific desired outcome. This is sometimes referred to as shaking down the people, accessing money and opportunities through deceitful, underhanded, and shady ways of pressuring vulnerable people or companies. Our process began mainly as a receptacle of stories being shared in unburdening, but soon it became apparent to us that there were discernible patterns of systemic undermining of governance that go beyond what we call petty corruption, as if corruption could ever be petty, so as to seriously threaten constitutional democracy. Therefore, while corruption, which is part of the brief of our anchoring democracy, the SACC processes on democracy are concerned also with the broader issues of South Africa's constitutional democracy. When it became clear that the trouble was beyond petty corruption, we shifted from listening for unburdening to the mode of the SACC approach of See, Judge, Act. Of course, the see is the research, and the judge is the application of our gospel values to what we now know to be the reality. And the act is how we resolve to deal with what we have encountered. Through the see process, the listening and the research stage, it became clear that the problem was far greater than and beyond corruption, but rather a large-scale design for nefarious mafia-style control of public enterprises and other significant governmental agencies and state organs. A careful analysis makes the case for the following observable trends of inappropriate control of state systems through a power elite that is pivoted around the President of the Republic, that is systemically siphoning the assets of the state and blunting any possible effective means for law enforcement. They do this by, we chose to stay with the number 7. There's a whole lot more, but you know, 7 is a biblical number. And so we have stayed with 7. Securing control of state wealth through the capture of state-owned companies by chronically weakening their governance and operational structures. Second, securing control of the public service by weeding out skilled professionals. Three, securing access to rent-seeking opportunities by shaking down regulations to their advantage and to the disadvantage of South Africans. Four, securing control over the country's fiscal sovereignty, made through the practice of guarantees that mortgage the country's future fiscal stability. Five, securing control over strategic procurement opportunities by intentionally weakening key technical institutions and formal executive processes. Six, securing a loyal intelligence and security apparatus. And finally, securing parallel governance and decision-making structures that undermine the executive. Now, in this context also, the appointment of poorly skilled and inexperienced individuals to the board and executive management of state-owned companies, but who are compliant to the power elite and or to a particular group, is widespread. Skilled professionals with a strong commitment to the Constitution are systematically weeded out of the public service and replaced by individuals who are less competent but more willing to abide by power elite imperatives. Once the public good officials are neutralized, state companies are able to proceed with transactions that are not in the interests of the country. Now, Eskom is a perfect illustrative case of securing control over state wealth through the capture of state-owned companies and weeding out of conscientious skilled professionals. It is South Africa's largest consumer of coal. It is an extremely attractive cash cow for corrupt interests. Would you not wonder what it is that necessitates that the two Transnet tender chiefs, Ryan Molefe and Anuj Singh, be both redeployed to Eskom from Transnet to carry on in the Eskom environment in their respective roles? Eskom is big with both coal and the tantalizing opportunities through its nuclear power project. The proposed 9.6 gigawatts nuclear project is one of the largest public investments programs in South African history. Compared to the size of our economy, it would be one of the biggest investments undertaken by any country in the world. Therefore, the decision has to be taken in the best interests of every South African, not sectional business interests. The consequences otherwise would be catastrophic for us, our children and our grandchildren, and our great-grandchildren for decades to come. The churches were opposed to the nuclear power model for three reasons. First, the environmental hazards associated with it, not only because of what we have seen in the accidents occurring in the more developed countries like Japan and Chernobyl in Russia, but also because of the abiding question of how to safely dispose of nuclear waste in South Africa. Secondly, the relatively higher cost of nuclear energy as against renewable options than lend themselves in the South African environment. And thirdly, the secretive manner in which the whole procurement process is managed, a situation through which corruption thrives. However, this third and the last of these concerns seems to have claimed pole position, to use the Formula One language, as research as well as just putting together what is already in the public domain would suggest. Now, the widespread and deeper levels at which the power elite's design has been able to reach has us wondering if it can easily be reversed without a thoroughgoing reform of governmental systems to plug the holes. We wish to make it clear to the Portfolio Committee that, commendable as this effort is to get to the bottom of the capture of public enterprises, beginning as you do with Eskom, the Eskom case is not isolated, nor is that of Transnet, PRASA, Denel, SAA, SABC, but that it reaches out to other organs of state, elements of the security services, and so on. And it has a cancerous effect up and down the governmental system, both sociocultural and economic impacts. It sets the cultural tone, the ways things get done around here. And for the upright to be isolated, sidelined, and made to feel out of place because they are towing the line of the constitutional order. Now, at each point where it touches, it has serious economic impacts. The loss of jobs, the loss of public trust, the loss of predictability of policy with a whimsical political regime. This is immoral, unethical, perverse, obscene, and unreservedly unacceptable. It is the stuff that would prompt Prophet Habakkuk to complain to God, "Your eyes are too pure to look on evil. You cannot tolerate wrongdoing. Why then do you tolerate the treacherous? Why are you silent while the wicked swallow up those more righteous than themselves?" The principles of cooperative government and intergovernmental relations in Section 41 of the Constitution, Chapter 3, says that all organs of state must secure the well-being of the people of the Republic, provide effective, transparent, accountable, and coherent government for the Republic as a whole, be loyal to the Constitution, the Republic, and its people. We wonder if the governmental system remains within these constitutional parameters today. The key point here is that the capture of state-owned institutions, the raiding of departmental budgets, and the walling off into a protected cage of various strategic institutions is the very nature of state capture for a chosen few and for God to see to the interests of the rest of the Republic. The authors of our Constitution, many of whom are still alive, assumed that the leaders of the executive would always act in the best of public good in accordance with their oath of office. In that spirit, they were vested with the responsibility for the appointment of boards, even with cabinet ratification. The cabinet was supposed to be above reproach, but when doubts emerge based on what has been experienced, the question arises as to whether state-owned enterprises boards should not require the ratification of a broader body like the legislature, provided that the legislators themselves uphold their premier and constitutional responsibility as sworn representatives of the people and their interests, rather than the narrow interests of their political parties. That is the ideal world, but that is the imperative of public ethics. Ethical questions may well be asked. How come the same network of companies associated with specific individuals somehow manage to have what seems to be a prescience of potential lucrative projects, and not only land these, but in some instances get assisted to qualify and exploit these opportunities? Now, John Foster, in making a case that the public protests in our streets were orchestrated by a few upstockers, cried out, "These same faces are seen causing trouble in different parts of the country. The same people, the same faces." In that vein, we ask, where are all other South African companies? It is our turn to use John Foster's phrase. This poses serious ethical questions when the same companies involve members of families and close friends of senior government leaders, and no less a leader as the President of the Republic. The critical lines of public ethics may indeed have been crossed, most evidently in the public enterprises such as Eskom and Transnet. We have argued before that, and I quote from that, ethics in any society is like the serum in the bloodstream, which makes for the consistency and integrity and trustworthiness of the governmental relationship between citizens and government in the organs of state. Ethics in democracy is about ensuring that the governmental systems and operations faithfully and fairly, justly, serve the best possible interests of the citizens, the public. As religious bodies, we believe that this ethical imperative thrives on the principles of the light as against the darkness of subterfuge. And on this, St. John writes, "This is the message we have heard from him and announced to you, that God is light, and in him there is no darkness at all." We say it is only the culture of light that will restore good governance and restore the integrity of our public institutions. Our constitution refers to this as transparent, accountable, and coherent government for the Republic as a whole. That is the basis of the South Africa we pray for, a just, reconciled, peaceful, equitable, and sustainable South Africa, free of racism, tribalism, sexism, and xenophobia, free of corruption and deprivation, and for every child born to grow to its God-given potential. Sithuma kube njalo. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Reverend Umlwana. I am not sure if in any of the people in the South African Council of Churches would want to add on what you have said, or you are satisfied. This is what you are presenting to us. So you believe so. Okay. Thank you very much for the presentation. Members, we will ask questions after all the presentation. Please note your questions. I know some of the presentations that are given are not, they are coming, but they are not in front of us. But in any way, you will listen to what the presentations that are put in front of us. We are not going to throw the documents away. We are still going to use the documents also, getting towards the inquiry as the committee members. So don't feel like you are not privileged, or your rights have been taken because you did not have the presentation in front of you. We have received the presentation this morning. The presentations this morning, they are being printed. So please just try to listen to the verbal presentation and take notes. Honorable Tsedi.
Thanks. I just want to check if the arrangement has been made for us to have copies of the presentation that you just made.
That's what I have just said. The presentations are coming.
Oh, okay.
That's what I was saying. Thank you. Honorable Luyenge.
Thanks, Chairperson. Maybe it's not a different view, Chair, but let me ask if it will be a train smash if we deal with this particular report of the SACC, especially if the other presenters are not yet ready now, because I feel this particular report is not just a report, because it carries some divine messages came to the clergy fraternity, so we cannot deal with them like any other report.
Thank you, Honorable Leanga. I did not say the presenters are not ready. The presenters are ready. What we do not have in front of us is the presentations. Honorable Shivam?
No, thanks, Chair. I thought that these documents that were circulated are the presentations that are going to be given now. There's a presentation written No Room to Hide, which is done by the author. So I think it's there. Let's take the presentation and then we'll then take everything else afterward. I think let's continue in that stream of presentations and then we'll then make the commentary afterward. Sure.
Thank you, Honorable Shivambo. You have a privilege of having the file. I don't have the file in front of. That is why I am saying the presentations are not here. But if we agree on what I have said, we will carry on. Honorable Mankanen Kungubel.
Chair of Sanders. Chair, I think I want to support the approach you are taking. I just wanted to say, Honorable Shivambo, it appears that it's more factual chronology of issues that are here, but the presentation the bishop has made is not exactly similar, although there's consistency. There's a chronology of facts, there's a very informative presentation, actually very inspiring presentation he has made. So they're not exactly the same, so we would need what they say together with what they have given us. I'd support that to proceed.
Thank you very much, honorable members. The presentations will come. The presenters are prepared to present, but the copies of the presentation will come. Honorable Swart.
Chair, I just wanted to support my colleague in that we have a presentation from the church and it is a prophetic voice, a divine voice, so we need to ensure that we've got enough time to engage very carefully. We opened in prayer, which is a very significant and important matter. And we need to be mindful of the criticism as well that the church has had of being involved in politics. And from my side, we obviously, and I'm sure everyone here supports the view that it is very important for the church to speak out against issues in our nation at this time. So I am in your hands, but I do want us to ensure that we've got enough time to engage with the leaders from the church, because this is not just another presentation. From our view, this is a very, very important prophetic word from God at this time in our nation. And so I want to align myself with my colleague here to ensure that we hear very carefully as a nation what is being said by the church to us as leaders at this time. And I'm sure you will allow that sufficient time. Thank you, Chairperson.
Honorable members, I have asked this day from Parliament for us to sit as a committee. We do not have a sitting at 2 o'clock. We have the whole day to us. I know there are members who have indicated that they will leave us, but I think we have a whole day to us. It depends on us as members of Parliament, how much do we want to engage with the presentation. I think we have the whole day. We can sit. I've prepared myself to sit for 2 days, but I've prepared you only for this day of today. But I want to give us, we are going to have enough time to engage with the presentations, all of them. All of them. We will have enough time. I will now give over to the outer to give us the findings of the No Room to Hide report. Thank you very much, members, for understanding.
Thank you, Chair and honorable members. Before we report back on certain issues of the report, we're not going to deal with the report as a whole. I think this meeting was set out to concentrate on Eskom matters and the Department of Public Enterprises. So to deal with the whole report, we can use those 2 days that the chair provided for. But just a bit of background, ALTA started about a year ago to investigate certain information and on state capture. We looked into different sources, and we looked at media releases, we looked at the Pari report, the Church's Council report, and we also got a lot of information from whistleblowers, brave men and women that will put their careers on the line to come and speak to us because they feel that they must contribute and do something about the situation in the country. Just one remark. As the Bishop said, I think that this battle of state capture is our battle. Our children, it's important for our children and grandchildren, but this is our battle. They're going to have their own battles, like global warming, the protection of natural resources, etc. And that's why it's so important that we must take hands and fight this battle together, and see that our country comes first, and that our country's resources doesn't get wasted. We had out of sea the taxes of the country, as you know, water being put down a feeding pipe to a dam for all in South Africa to be used. What's happening is that there are holes being punched by certain individuals, certain entities in this feeding pipe. The water is getting wasted, and it's getting captured by certain individuals, and at the end of the pipe, the dam is getting emptier and emptier, and there's not going to be enough resources to service all the people of South Africa if we do not make a plan at this stage. Chair and honourable members, our report, No Room to Hide, a present court in the Act, was prepared over a time of about 4 or 5 weeks after we received the so-called leaked mails. And that gave a lot of evidence to investigations that we were already busy with. After the completion of the report, we handed it over on the 28th of June to the Speaker of Parliament, also to the chief whips of all the political parties represented in Parliament. We handed copies to the Minister of Police, the Public Protector, the National Prosecuting Authority, the Hawks, also the National Executive Council of the ruling party, and we published it on our website for everybody to see and for everybody to read. What I'm going to do today is only going to touch on a few of the matters that's important to this committee regarding Eskom. If you look at the report, there is a few individuals, entities that's reported on with evidence in this regarding Eskom in the report. I'm going to start off, if you can just give me 1 second here. You will see that there is certain individuals that is in the report. Then there will be individuals that's not in the report itself. We are busy doing more investigations. We received a lot of information from whistleblowers, from other parties that I've mentioned before. And we are compiling a second report, as this is something that we really take care to do, not to rush it, and to make sure of our facts. Then, after I've reported back on these individuals, Mr. Blom will report back on Eskom, the Brian Molefe pension situation, also Trillion, and the current or the financials that were published a few days ago. If we carry on to the next slide, the first person that's very important and that we came across, especially in the mails, is Mr. Anoj Singh. Previously, Mr. Singh was the CFO of Transnet from July 2012 until August 2015. In August 2015, he was appointed by Minister Lynn Brown as the CFO of Eskom. There's a clear relationship between the Gupta family and Mr. Singh, dating back to 2012 already. What we have found, evidence that we have found regarding this relationship, is that the Gupta family funded certain trips for Mr. Singh to Dubai. You will see there the 6th to the 9th of June 2014, where he stayed in the Oberoi Hotel in Dubai. In brackets there, the whole report and the annexures, like I said, is in the is on our website. And in brackets there is the referral to the specific piece of evidence in our report. Anybody is welcome to go. It is a pile of paper, and I didn't want to bring everybody a copy of that. We could not afford the excess weight flying it up from flying it down from Gauteng to here. But it is available, and everybody can have a look at that. Now, this trip, you will see, was just 3 months after Transnet awarded the locomotives tender. From 7 to 12 August 2014, the same in the Oberoi Hotel in Dubai, there was a clear message, and this is an indication that the Gupta family paid for these trips. It's from Mr. Ashu Shawa, the COO of Sahara, that handled a lot of business for the Gupta family, where he wrote to the hotel, please swipe the card for all charges. This trip was just before, if I remember correctly, Newtel was notified that they were a new preferred bidder for Transnet. Then on the next slide, the 7 to 9 November 2014, same Oberoi Hotel. This was just weeks after the award of the new TEL contract of worth 1.8 billion rand. There was two other trips as well, the 24th to the 26th of February 2015 and 13th to 15th June 2015. And then after the appointment of Mr. Singh as CFO of Eskom, there was a trip 17 to 24 December to Dubai, and this was just days after the Tegeta obtained the optimum coal mine. If we go to the next slide, there's another individual that can be connected to Eskom, as well as a very important member of the Department of Public Enterprises, Mr. Richard Seleke. Now, Mr. Seleke is the current Director General of the Department of Public Enterprises. Something to note is that the appointment of a DG vests exclusively in the President. Just a bit of background on Mr. Seleke. He was previously also a non-executive director on the Transnet board. And he started off his public service career in the Free State under current Minister Musa Ben Siswane. Now, in the mails, there was a very prominent person who wrote a lot of mails, or who received and transferred a lot of mails, and this with the email address infoportal1@zoho.com with the screen name of Businessman. Now, Businessman sent his own CV to Mr. Duduzani Zuma on the 29th of June, and once again the annexures there in brackets, you can refer to the annexures in the report itself. A few months after that CV that was sent, Mr. Seleke was appointed as the DG of Department of Public Enterprises. On the next slide, Mr. Seleke acted as a postman, if you can call it that. He received classified and confidential information from DPE, and he forwarded it to the Gupta family. On 7 January 2015, that's when it all started. He received an email from the China South Rail, a subsidiary of China South Rail, and that was immediately forwarded to Mr. Ashu Shawa, the COO of Sahara. On 7 August 2015, Mr. Seleke will forward a letter that he received from Mr. Machila Koko from Eskom regarding the optimum business or from the optimum business rescuers, where they discussed certain situations regarding the business rescue procedures of Optimum. That mail was sent by Mr. Koko to Mr. Seleke, and immediately he resent it to Mr. Shawa to keep the Gupta family, I believe, in the loop. Then on 4 November 2015, Eskom received a privileged legal opinion from senior counsel, and this legal opinion once again was sent by Mr. Koko to Mr. Seleke, and he will forward it to Mr. Tony Gupta. On the next slide, we carry on with Mr. Seleke. 4 November, Eskom will receive a letter from a company called Just Coal discussing a contract regarding coal supply and the problems that not only Just Coal but other few coal suppliers have got with Eskom. This letter, once again, sent from Mr. Machila Koko to Mr. Tony Gupta, with Mr. Seleke being the postman. Then there's a range of annexes that you will see in the report where Mr. Seleke was always included in the Denel Asia matter, from where Denel Asia tried to form the joint venture and being created, etc., etc. Mr. Seleke, infoportal1@zoho.com, was always included in these mails. The reason we could not get behind what will the reason be, I mean, he is in a public position there, but why use this aka email address? And I'm very sure that all the other people that sent these mails to him or included him in this correspondence must have known who, you know, what's the identity of infoportal1@zoho.com or businessman. There is a wide range or a whole lot of these emails regarding Denel Asia, the forming of Denel Asia, etc. Then on 24 November 2015, Minister Lynn Brown sent a letter to Denel. It was marked very clearly in red, the original letter, as confidential. Mr. Seleke chose to forward this letter straight away to Mr. Ashu Chawa, and the evidence therefore and the documents also in the annexes to our report. Something that shows that Mr. Seleke was informed about or knew about the Tequesta matter, and Tequesta was the company that was set up to negotiate the locomotives deal back in 2015, Tequesta being the company of Mr. Salim Essa. For some reason, Mr. Seleke must have been part of this, or the explanation still unknown to us, but he was in possession of a Tequesta letterhead that he forwarded to Mr. Ashu Chawa, and we saw later on that there was various correspondence sent on these Tequesta letterheads. Lastly, regarding Mr. Seleke, on 1 March 2016, there was a spreadsheet prepared regarding the analyzing trends in the exchange rate of South Africa and the South African rand, as well as the ministers of finance, etc., you know, sketching a whole picture regarding the financial state or the economic state of the country, also forwarded straight to Mr. Tony Gupta. That was received from, if I remember correctly, from financial company, the auditors that prepared this for publication, I believe. The next slide, we move on to Mr. Mochela Foko. As we all know, Mr. Koko was a former acting CEO of Eskom. I'm not going to repeat all of this. I think it was clearly stated. The correspondence that he forwarded, classified and confidential correspondence that he forwarded to Mr. Seleke, and that was then forwarded to the Gupta family. But on the last point there, 4 or 5 January 2016, Mr. Koko was also entertained by the Gupta family in the Oberoi Hotel in Dubai, and this invoice was paid by Sahara Computers, the evidence also in as annexes to our report. On the next slide, like I said, we're not going to go into depth with other individuals, persons, etc., not related to Eskom, but in our report also reported on Mr. Dan Macha, the chairperson of the NEL, who were also flown to Dubai and, if I remember correctly, Delhi in India as well by the Gupta family on numerous occasions. Shortly, the first trip shortly after his appointment as the chairperson of the NEL. Mr. Ipal Sharma, a former non-executive director of Transnet Board, there is a big part in the report that shows his involvement with especially the locomotives transaction as well as the VR laser situation, but like I said, not relevant to the Eskom report here. And then something that's not in the report, it's an ongoing investigation. This is Kim Davids, he's the personal assistant to the minister, to Minister Lynn Brown. She was also entertained by the Gupta family. If I remember the dates correctly, it was 27 December 2015 to 31st of December 2015, when she was flown to Dubai and paid for, stayed in the Oberoi Hotel and paid for by the Gupta family. Mr. Blom will take you through to the rest of the of our slides and our presentation regarding other companies and also the financials. I just want to make a last comment. At ALTA we believe and that we are, or let me put it to you this way, a few months ago, a very prominent politician asked the country to stand up and to connect the dots. And I believe that this is what ALTA is trying to do, is to connect the dots. We see a lot of dots out there, and hopefully we can connect those and for a better future for all. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Honourable Members.
Thank you very much. Oh, you're giving over to Mr. Mo.
If you can change the slide, please. To the next one. Okay. The people that I'm going to talk about will be done very briefly because I think they're all characters that we know. In the discussions of Mr. Malefe's role at Eskom, I think what really comes to the fore is that there seems to be a lot of confusion as to how he arrived at Eskom and how he departed at Eskom. For instance, if you look at the...
Sorry for interruption. Can you please speak to the mic?
My apologies.
Yeah.
If you look at an extract from the financial statements, we'll see that they inform us that the change of directors took place for Mr. Malefe on the 31st of December. If we turn to the next slide, we see that there's a statement by Mr. Brian Malefe where he offers his resignation, but he offers it from the 1st of January 2017. Now, it might seem nebulous, but the fact of the matter is if we're going to have a court case where these dates are all in dispute and not clarified, I can guarantee you who will win the outcome of this. As far as I can ascertain, and I've been involved with Eskom since 1988, when Eskom was still recognized as one of the top utilities in the world, top five utilities in the world, and half of my job was trying to fix up problem areas within Eskom, leading a team of postgrads. The other half of my job was taking investors and engineers from around the world to illustrate them how well Eskom was being managed and run to the benefit of, at that time, a part of the population at a very low cost. And that is something that really, really burns me, is how the costs of Eskom have run away under the last three regimes at Eskom. And I'll take you through that. If you can move to the next slide. As far as the involvement of Trillion Capital is concerned, and I believe in these houses, there was a denial that there was any contract with Trillion Capital. At the financial statements announcement last week, Eskom Board announced that there was a payment of $495 million to Trillion Capital. Several members of the board indicated that they had no knowledge of these payments. I put up on the slide an invoice dated the 31st of January 2016, addressed to Mr. Singh directly. 2 days before this, a letter was dispatched by Trillion Capital informing Mr. Singh that Trillion was the business development partner of McKinsey and asked for permission to be paid directly. I assume that Mr. Singh acquiesced to that request, otherwise this invoice wouldn't have followed 2 days later. The second thing about this invoice is the amount. The amount is an amount of around 30 million rand, and it's highlighted as a pro rata payment for the rewriting of the Eskom corporate plan. Now, I've been involved in writing corporate plans for the best part of my life, of business life of about 35 years, and in my whole history, I've never been involved in a corporate plan of such enormity, notwithstanding the fact that it was part of my job when I was at Eskom in the late 80s. So I'm astounded that a pro rata payment for a corporate plan, and I assume it's in the order of 30% because Trillion was the 30% partner in the McKinsey joint venture, would indicate a payment of in excess of 100 million. And this is not the only corporate plan. It seems to me Eskom does a corporate plan every year, and it doesn't seem to affect the results in a positive manner. So the reason I highlight this invoice is firstly to indicate that Mr. Singh was the recipient of this invoice and instructed for it to be paid. So Mr. Singh cannot deny that he was unaware that Trillion Capital was a service provider to Eskom. If we can go to the next slide. In the documentation, I highlighted there the clause that indicates that Trillion was appointed a 30% service provider to McKinsey. If we go to the next slide, we see that McKinsey was paid 900 million in consulting fees. Now, I assume this is on top of the corporate plan consulting fees. However, Trillion received, according to the Eskom board last week, 495 million. It seems to me the maths has gone astray, because 495 million is not a third of 900 million. The reason I point this out to the committee is that it's obvious that even the Eskom board last Wednesday were clutching at feathers. They didn't know what they were talking about. If you can go to the next slide. During the presentation that the Eskom board presented to the press and later on to the investment analysts, I need to point out to the committee that I was declined the opportunity to ask questions at the press release. I suspect Eskom thought I might be grandstanding, but I was allowed to ask questions at the analysts' meeting afterwards. In neither of those presentations did Eskom mention anything about the qualification to their financial results by the auditors. They mentioned that the reason for the postponement of the annual financial results was due to legal issues relating to the labor issues around Mr. Koko and Mr. Molefe. When we got hold of the results after the meeting, it's also significant that the results were not available during the meeting. They were only handed out after the meeting. Madam Chair, as you can see, this is probably the smallest font I've ever seen financial results being printed in. It's about a 4 font from in my estimate. But if you read carefully between the lines, you'll see there's in the middle of the page a reference to irregularities. And if you read the detail of those irregularities, it seems to me that the auditors, Sizwe and Atabule, found irregular payments in the Eskom accounts amounting to some 3 billion rands. I say billion with a bravo. Madam Chair, it's a lot of money. It makes peanuts out of the fees that Trillion was earning and these other Gupta companies are earning. And the concern there is that Sizwe Natsabule could not find any source documents for these 3 billion rands of payments. Now, I'm aware, and a number of the members of this committee will be aware, that Eskom operates the SAP accounting system, SAP. And to the best of my knowledge, the system is incredibly robust, and that's why it's so wildly popular around the world. And if you don't have all the details filled in and all the lines filled, you cannot process a payment in the SAP system, or a transaction for that matter. So all I can conclude, Madam Chair, is that from this statement, where 3 billion was processed without source documents, is that somewhere in Eskom, there's either somebody with a golden key who can override the SAP system, and we know that SAP has been receiving money from the Gupta family, or alternatively, there's an old checkbook that hasn't been burnt and is run in parallel to the SAP system so that payments can be made without source documentation. Whichever the case may be, Madam Chair, it's a case for serious, serious concern. Because as easy as this 3 billion could disappear, so could the other billions in Eskom's treasury disappear. I ask that the committee focus on this when they do their full investigation, please. If you can go to the next slide. At the same financial presentation last week, the board indicated that they were totally unaware that Mr. Singh had signed off a financial guarantee in favor of Tegeta days before the optimum transaction was concluded, to the tune of 1.68 billion rand. Madam Chair, it's a pity we can't read this font again because it's so small, but the clauses that are highlighted there indicate that all the corporate governance procedures have been fulfilled. And this is on an APSA document. They were assured that all the corporate governance procedures had been fulfilled before APSA endorsed this guarantee issued by Eskom in favor of Tegeta. Madam Chair, why do we present this document? The reason we present this document is not to advertise APSA. The reason we present this document is to indicate that there is a fundamental breakdown of governance within Eskom, including Eskom's legal department, who allegedly also endorsed this document if you look at the last clause on this page. It is unheard of for a government entity to issue such magnitude guarantees for a private company to buy another private company. This is not for the source and supply of material. This is for one company to have the cash available to buy another company. Madam Chair, if you add this 1.6 billion together with the 600 odd million that Eskom prepaid for coal, it brings you to a princely sum of 2.1 billion, which just happens to be the asking price for Optimum Coal from Glencore. I don't think one needs to be a genius to add the two numbers together and to see that there's more to the story than we have been told. If we can move to the next slide, please. I mentioned earlier on in my deliberations that I'm very concerned about the cost of Eskom running away. I refer you here to an extract from the chairman's statement from the Eskom financials for 2005. Again, it's very fine print, but nevertheless, if you read the highlighted number there, I think it says 93 billion. And this 93 billion is the chairman's estimate of full capital expenditure that will be required by Eskom for the next 5 years. Madam Chair, that's from 2005 until 2010. I feel sad at having to mention this, because this number includes Medupi, ostensibly Kusile, as well as Ngula, three big capital projects that were on Eskom's radar at that time. I need to mention to the committee that I was consulting to Eskom from 2006 to 2008. I was pulled in again to help them resuscitate the coal procurement plan that had gone astray. And having previously worked at Eskom in the financial division responsible for coal procurement, it was very easy for me to regenerate the document. Whilst I was waiting for my time to pass and awaiting further instruction to help with the execution of the coal procurement plan, Mr. Damas removed the coal procurement department from the Eskom head office and instituted additional security around that building. I was not allowed into that building. During that time, around about mid-2008, I was showed an invoice or a quotation document for Medupi to be complete. The first one I saw was for 26 billion. However, it was defective because it only included 4 units. I indicated that to the person who presented it to me. They went away and came back about a month and a half later with an invoice for 32 billion rand for Medupi Power Station 6-pack, as per Eskom's normal qualifications. I need to mention to the committee that at the same time, a power station tender was issued in India for a similar size for 35 billion rand. So the numbers seem to be more or less consistent, around the 30 billion odd rand for a 6-pack power station capable of generating more than 4,000 megawatts. My contract expired in October that year, notwithstanding the assurances I'd been given by the Eskom financial director, Mr. Bongani Ngubaba, who was subsequently pushed out of Eskom, that my contract would be extended for 10 years to ensure the proper implementation of the coal procurement plan. I was thus astonished when I saw later in the year that Eskom's board had approved the Medupi power station at 91 billion rand. Madam Chair, the question I need to ask is, where did the additional 60 billion come from? As events unfolded, we were subsequently informed that the suppliers to the Medupi power station had been swapped. Hitachi, which is known worldwide for its excellence in turbines, had been swapped out from its tender for the turbines to the boiler, and Alstom, which is known worldwide for its professionalism in boiler building, was swapped out to provide the turbine. And that's where the technical mess at Medupi started. I was also later informed that the parties, that Hitachi had to engage with a BE partner, which, for the record, happens to be Chancellor House. Madam Chair, I think those entities need to be interrogated to find out where the additional 60 billion rand in costs came from. If we go to Eskom's financials of last year, we are informed that not only has Medupi escalated to well over 150 billion rand, but the same Mr. Damas took it upon himself to photocopy the Medupi contract and allocate the Kusile players without a tender. I think that is a gross irregularity. I have publicly been complaining about this since 2009. My record is in the press. You can go and have a look at it. Nobody believed me at the time that there was gross corruption within Eskom. I'd also come across more than 8 billion rand in my estimate at that time in coal frauds, where coal was allegedly being shipped from one power station to the other, defended by quality differences, but which was absolute nonsense. It was just fraud and more fraud and more fraud. I uncovered the fact that it was organized crime. I was told by Eskom's investigators that there was a syndicate of 54 people in that syndicate of the organized crime, including a very prominent member of parliament at that time. I ask this committee to investigate that further, please. If we can go to the next slide. For those who thought my 93 billion for the three projects was stupid and a guess, the director's report of 2005 again mentions, highlighted there, 93 billion for all Eskom capex for the next 5 years. Again, we must ask ourselves, how did 30 billion for Medupi become 150 billion today? And similarly for Kusile, Ngula's 20-odd billion became 40 billion. Madam Chair, there are vast amounts of money that are just disappearing in front of our eyes. If you can go to the next slide. As I mentioned up front, I'm very concerned at Eskom's money being blown away. If we go to that slide, we'll see at the bottom that in 2005, if we assume Eskom was efficiently run at that time, the cost of electricity was around about 16 cents a kilowatt hour. We were then all bulldozed into believing that Eskom couldn't fund the build through the markets and that we had to increase the tariffs drastically to pre-fund the power stations. At that time, I went public and said it was the most ridiculous proposal I've ever come across, because you don't pay for a house before you move into it. It's a long-term asset. You pay as you go. You take bonds and you go and you pay every year over the 40-odd years or longer. Eskom chased the electricity price up from 16 cents in 2005, and the latest application will take them to over a rand a kilowatt hour. If Eskom had been run efficiently as the NERSA regulations require for them to get a guaranteed price increase, we can take the Eskom price of 2005 and escalate it by CPI every year, by a factor of CPI, not the full CPI, because two-thirds of Eskom's costs are fixed. The bonds are not affected by inflation, and the fixed plant are not affected by inflation. They spent monies. So only the operational cost escalates every year. If we add CPI to the 16 cents of 2005, Madam Chair, you and I should today not be paying more than 30 cents a kilowatt hour. Eskom will come to NERSA in the next month asking for over a rand a kilowatt hour. If we add up the excess monies that has been stolen from us by Eskom over the last 10 years, because they have fleeced our pockets by big increases, and behind our backs they've also gone to the bond market and raised government bonds of over 350 billion, plus non-government bonds of another 100-odd billion rand. So not only have they taken the money from our pockets, they've indebted our nation to the tune of over 350 billion rand for the same assets. If we add all that excess money together, we get over a trillion rand, Madam Chair. The assets were only supposed to cost 90 billion rand. I think Eskom owes us a massive refund, Madam Chair. To stop this nonsense, I'm going to ask this committee to investigate and to advise NERSA that the price, given that Eskom has now over-recovered more than 10 times the amount of money that they should have for these assets, that the operating price of electricity, goes back to where it should have been had Eskom been operated efficiently, and that we immediately revert to a price of under 30 cents a kilowatt hour. Can we go to the next slide, please? Thank you very much, Madam Chair. That's the end of my presentation.
Thank you very much. The presentation on AUTA, is it complete now? Do you have any other person that needs to add on what you have said? Madam. Honorable Lady Chair. Honorable Lady Chair, I would just like to say that out, I would like to commend and thank this committee for giving the concerned citizens the opportunity to speak here. It shows that state capture is being dealt with seriously and with the contempt that it deserves. State capture touches many sectors of our public entities, and we're confident that we're going to see more of these. We want to say that, again, we are going to investigate many, many more matters. We've laid about 3 charges so far, and we're looking at charging Mr. Tsileke next. We would like to thank you very much.
Thank you very much, madam. We are working on time. People who are worried about time, I think they can see that we are working on time because our presentations are they are being prepared very well so that we get everything in a small space of time, but you get more information. We will now give over to the third presenters, the last presenters of the day, which would be on the betrayal of the promise by the researchers, State Capacity Research Project. Thank you. I will give over to them now.
Honourable Chair Ranto, thank you very much. To the Portfolio Committee, thank you very much. And to members, thank you. My name is Ivy Chipkin. I'm the Director of the Public Affairs Research Institute based at Wits University and also at the University of Cape Town. I've been part of a research collaboration which we call the State Capacity Research Group, which brings together and was originally convened by Mark Swilling from Stellenbosch University, the Center for the Study of Complex Systems in Transition, Harun Borat at the Development Policy Research Unit at the University of Cape Town.
Sorry, can you please again speak to the mic, please?
Oh, sorry.
I know it's not easy.
I have to lean forward. All right, is that better?
The chairs are not comfortable.
Is that better? So again, it's my pleasure to be here. The Betrayal of the Promise report is an attempt by South African academics to respond to the current situation, not simply by producing new information in the putting in the information in the public domain, although I think we have done so, although I have to say that our report came out just as the Gupta leaks came out, so there's a lot more information which is in the public domain. But what we tried to do was to bring a whole range of new concepts to make sense of the current situation. So I think what has been reported and we've heard today are quite massive evidence of unethical behavior, immoral behavior, of illegality, and in many cases, straightforward criminality. What we've also found in the course of the work that we were doing was that underpinning these actions has been a political project, and this is what I want to talk about, and I think this is what the committee needs to come to terms with, that at the heart what is facilitating the current illegality, criminality, and certainly immoral behavior is a political conviction, and I want to spend some time discussing that. The Betrayal Report has brought together information that is already largely in the public domain. What we've done, to use that expression originally used by former Minister of Finance, Pravin Gordhan, was joining the dots. So we've brought information produced by leading journalists in South Africa, in particular, which have to be commended in the South African context of the team around Amabungani. Documents coming from government departments, National Treasury, Department of Trade and Industry, public enterprises, legal and court documents, statistical and financial sources. What we've done is we've collated this information, we've brought it together, and we've analyzed it together to see what story it tells. And what we say, as I say, is not we find not just a story of criminality and illegality, we find at the heart of this is a political project and how it affects the state and how state and enterprises come to play the enormous significant role in the current drama which we currently face. So that's the background to our group. What I think is important, we need to recognize the importance of the current moment. If I think back merely several weeks ago when we started doing this work earlier this year, the attention on the current political situation was not nearly as substantial as it is today, and I have to applaud this portfolio committee for taking these actions, because what it shows and it gives sign evidence of is a growing political will to address the situation. You're seeing a large mobilization of civil society organizations. There was a conference in Johannesburg last Tuesday, the largest gathering of civil society organizations in South Africa since 1994. A growing mobilization of political parties and of various forces in South African society around the issues of state capture. So I think this is to be celebrated, and I think it creates therefore an opportunity for a new kind of consensus going forward. A consensus premised on three things, and what we'll, as you'll see, discuss now. One is on a real model of economic transformation, which is absolutely necessary, which I'll talk about in a moment. Secondly, is a reaffirmation of the principles of the Constitution and a commitment to South Africa's democracy. And thirdly, a recommitment to a project of state building and public service reform. So I think we're in an opportunity where those three principles can be aligned and we can achieve potentially another historic breakthrough in South Africa. So let me go to the substance of the report, and I will gear my remarks to specifically around ESCOM, although there's some background that's required, because ESCOM is an instance of a larger phenomenon which focuses on the state of enterprises. But I'll gear my remarks towards the examples I give will be around the ESCOM. So what we've argued is that underpinning the current situation, as I mentioned, is a political conviction. And the political conviction we think arises in the aftermath of 2007, after the Polokwane revolt within the African National Congress, which we argue was a fundamental repudiation of the political economy of the Thabo Mbeki years, and its particular economic and social features. So even though the Thabo Mbeki years under Gear had produced the fastest economic growth that South Africa has seen in the last 30, 40 years, we approached almost 5%, the argument that emerged in the aftermath of Polokwane, an argument which I think is absolutely was correct, was that this growth was associated with the emergence of a small economic elite, a vulnerable middle class, and massive then economic exclusion. An economic exclusion which took a particular form, economic exclusion for people in rural areas, and in urban areas, in informal settlements, and on the margins of the cities, massive economic exclusion. And who are excluded fundamentally? It's a lot of people unlikely that are present in this room. People that didn't speak English fluently or spoke very accented English. It's people that weren't educated at all or weren't very well educated. These are the people that have been marginalized fundamentally by that model of economic growth of the early 2000s. So what you see after Polokwane is the search for more radical models of economic transformation, especially ones that will put South Africa on a more inclusive growth path, to use the current terminology, but one that can undo and reshape the fundamentals of the South African economy. And there are a whole range of models that begin to emerge. We know, for example, Julius Malema is the former head of the ANC Youth League, is promoting a return to the principles of the Freedom Charter, the nationalization of land and of the mines. In other parts of the ANC, though, other models of economic transformation are being searched for. The first idea is mooted by the Department of Economic Development, is around public procurement, very quietly in the new growth path. These ideas are taken up in parts of the ANC, but especially within the Department of Trade and Industry, which starts seeing public procurement, and especially the public procurement of state-owned enterprises, as a route through which massive economic transformation can be achieved. We find a document from the Department of Trade and Industry from 2011 listing all the state-owned enterprises and listing the procurement budgets, producing a figure of about 210 billion rand, 210 billion rand of procurement spend in only 13 state-owned enterprises, which the argument when, and this is the first time we hear the expression radical economic transformation, we can use that procurement spend to do two things: displace existing white firms, but also encourage the emergence of new black-owned and black-owned enterprises. In other words, one can use the procurement budgets of state-owned enterprises to create, if you like, a new kind of black-owned and black-controlled industrial economy. It's very easy to see why these ideas are compelling and very, very exciting. I think they are exciting ideas. We argue, though, and this becomes very, very key in the analysis, during that period, though, there is a turn, And we don't believe the turn is necessary. We believe it is contingent. In other words, it's not produced by a necessary following of the logic. We argued around 2011, around 2012, the protagonists of radical economic transformation, this model of using the state as enterprises and using the procurement budgets of state enterprises to engineer an economic transformation, increasingly start turning against the Constitution and in particular constitutional bodies like the National Treasury. And the argument here, I think, is quite technical, so forgive me for a moment. If you look at the difference, if you look at the final constitution in relationship with the interim constitution, you will notice two surprising developments. In the interim constitution, National Treasury is not mentioned at all. In the final constitution, the National Treasury is a constitutional body, which means how the National Treasury behaves is not a matter of policy and is not a matter of legislation. It is dictated to by the constitution. That's the first thing. The second development, which is also surprising, is that public procurement is a constitutional matter. It is in the Constitution. Perhaps the crafters of our Constitution were very prescient about how South African politics might develop in the coming years. The constitutional provision around procurement requires the two principles are reconciled. They clearly imagined that they were easily reconcilable, or perhaps reconcilable with some difficulty, but nonetheless reconcilable. So there are two principles in public procurement in the Constitution. The first one is what we might call a principle of good value. It requires, this is not at the discretion of the minister, it's not at the discretion of the ruling party, it's not a matter of policy, it is a constitutional requirement that requires that public procurement pays attention to price, the price of the goods or services that are being acquired, the competency of the service provider, and their experience. Those are constitutional requirements. The second principle is a principle of what we might call equity. It requires that public procurement favors previously disadvantaged people in South Africa. So the crafters of the Constitution clearly imagined that these two principles were reconcilable. Good value for money and economic justice. What is interesting, we start seeing around 2010, 2011, the protagonists of radical economic transformation are increasingly arguing that not only are those principles irreconcilable, but they are actually in fundamental contradiction, that you cannot pursue procurement which does justice, which achieves the purposes of economic justice or economic transformation in a way that achieves good value at the same time. So you see within the Department of Trade and Industry, but also from various groups, including the Black Management Forum, pressure on the National Treasury to include a 30% set-aside clause. In other words, that 30% of all public procurement is granted to black-owned and black-controlled firms, irrespective of experience, irrespective of price. We see in 2011 tremendous pressure on the National Treasury to pass those resolutions and extend those black economic empowerment considerations to state enterprises, and the former Minister of Finance does not do it. We think it's a key moment of the radicalization of the moment of the project of radical economic transformation, and increasingly the idea that National Treasury is an obstacle to this project. What we argue, and this is, I think, very, very important in how we understand what the developments of Treasury, we argue and we are able to demonstrate it, I think, quite clearly, and the evidence produced by OCHA and by the Southern Council of Churches, I think, confirm this over more and more, and the Gupta leaks confirm it more and more, is what you see in this turn away from the Constitution and a sense that constitutional is an obstacle to radical economic transformation and so is the law, it creates a general environment for illegality and growing criminalization. And what you start seeing from that period on is a growing illegality in the way in which state-owned enterprises are behaving. Much evidence has already been placed before this committee on what that looks like. The first examples are in Transnet around the procurement of trains to the value of 51 billion rand. We now know some of the detail around that contract, where it looks like the Gupta family were receiving 10 million rand for every 50 million rand train. It's just an extraordinary slice of the money that is leaking to the Guptas. In 2015, though, there's another cabinet reshuffle. Brian Malefi has moved from Transnet to Eskom, The board is changed. Many people are brought in, as the public protector revealed later. Public protector demonstrates that many of the new board members have very close or immediate links to the Gupta family. I'm not going to go through all the details. Let me just give you one example, though, which I think is a startling example. And you know some of the details, but one element of it hasn't come out as clearly as it should. And I think it gives a good sense of, for this committee going forward, some of the areas which you might want to probe around. It's around the value of the coal contracts. You know the story of the Glencore mine, Optimum. It's been discussed earlier. Optimum mine providing coal to Eskom power stations. The value of its contract historically was 325 million rand per annum. It's providing low quality coal to the mines, to the power station. Brian Malefi comes on board as the CEO of Eskom. A fine is imposed on Glencore because of the low quality of the coal, over 2 billion rand. It pushes the Optima mine into near bankruptcy, or to bankruptcy finally. Glencore appealed to renegotiate the contract under Brian Malefi's tutorship. They refused to renegotiate. The mine goes bankrupt. There are those extraordinary details that emerged around the Minister of Mines moving to Dubai to conclude that contract with Tegeta. We know those details, and I'm not going to go through them again. But what is extraordinary is the value of that contract. Almost immediately, if you go to the website of the Office of the Chief Procurement Officer, this new office which is established to provide oversight of procurement deals in South Africa. They show there's a little tab called irregularities and expansions, and you will see in that tab the value of the coal contract goes from 325 million rand per annum to 7 billion rand per annum. It's an extraordinary escalation, especially you have to remember that this is the same pile of low-quality coal that Eskom was historically paying a much, much lower price for. So I think there has been a lack of transparency on Eskom's side around those coal contracts. It is definitely an area which I think this committee needs to probe with some degree of vigor. So the Tegeta coal contract is merely one contract amongst a whole range of contracts, and as the delegation from OTA have explained, I think this is definitely what is driving up the costs of electricity and the costs of running the South African electricity system generally. So this is what is going on. We argue that there's this move to illegality, clear signs, I think, of criminality. But here is where I think things are get very, very, it's very, very important to understand the effects outside of the state of the enterprise into the broader state system and into the broader political system in South Africa. So what we argue, and we're able to demonstrate, I think, quite clearly, is that at the same time there is the shift to illegality and even to criminality, this idea, again, that one needs to operate outside the law, one needs to operate outside the Constitution in order to facilitate this model of economic transformation, we see moves against other state institutions, especially those state institutions that have built up a large investigative capacity and even a prosecutorial capacity. The first of those, of course, is the South African Revenue Services, which by 2014-2015 has built up into a formidable institution. SARS, of course, is one of the great heroic stories of post-apartheid South Africa, and it's worth just dwelling on it for a moment. By the end of the apartheid period, tax collection in South Africa is in a state of collapse. Non-compliance with tax regulations is absolutely widespread, both amongst private taxpayers but also amongst businesses. The ability to build an institution which is able to develop tremendous legitimacy amongst citizens and then put in place the institutional infrastructure to identify taxpayers, work out how much they owe, and then to collect that taxation is one of the great achievements of the ANC government in the post-apartheid period. By 2014-2015, SARS has not just developed a great infrastructure to be able to collect tax, it's also built up quite a formidable investigative capacity to find, to detect and find and move against non-compliance taxpayers, especially those responsible for, with potentially responsible for, with a large tax, with substantial amounts owing to the fiscus. What we see in 2015, to the end of 2014 are moves against the leadership of SARS. You know some of the details. Ivan Pillay, the deputy commissioner, is pushed out. 50 of the leading people at SARS are also pushed out. The circumstances are extraordinary. Many of them, you know that. You know them. A dodgy intelligence report appears alleging that there is a rogue unit within the South African Revenue Services. It's interesting that the original report of a rogue unit referred to a rogue unit operating within the intelligence services, not within SARS. It's worth following up on that. The report is the claims of a rogue unit are used to launch a what can only be regarded as a completely dodgy investigation by KPMG. That report is then used to expel the leadership. So we have the weakening of SARS. The same sort of events take place within the Hawks. Shadrach Sabir is head of the Hawks in Gauteng. He is involved in some very high-profile investigations, including against Charles Mgluli, who is head of crime intelligence. A dodgy intelligence report emerges at the same time, alleging that he is involved in the illegal rendition of Zimbabweans. The report has no substance, but it is used nonetheless to suspend Shadrach Sabir from his position. Charges are then laid against him. The same thing happens to the Hawks in KZN. General Boyson is accused, an intelligence report appears accusing General Boyson of being involved in a criminal, in the Cato Manor hit squad. The report is unfounded, he's suspended, charges are laid against him, he's won every single one of those cases. The same with the National Intelligence, the head of the Hawks nationally, Anwar Dramat, an intelligence report, it's the same story. And of course we know the story of the NPA. So at the moment when the project within Transnet and within state-owned enterprises generally, this model of economic transformation, moves towards illegal and criminal means, we start seeing moves against key state institutions outside of the parastatals, especially those with investigative capacity. At the same time, we argue that we start seeing the emergence of what we call a shadow state. Increasingly decision-making, political decision-making is moving out of constitutional bodies, of formal government channels, outside the ANC itself, into a whole range of locations and processes and networks which are certainly informal and are outside the constitutional and government processes. We call them kitchen cabinets, but you see it, cabinet processes themselves begin to weaken. Lots of decision making is taking place outside of cabinet in interministerial committees, but we're able to show, and more evidence has emerged to confirm, huge and profound decisions are taking place in informal locations, including in Johannesburg at the residence of the Guptas in Sachsenwald. We think Sachsenwald is one of several other of these informal locations where decision making and power has seeped away from formal constitutional bodies, away from government, and even from the ANC into these shadowy circumstances. So, what do we argue? We argue that what you're seeing in Transnet, and I encourage and I'm very excited that this portfolio committee has been established and proceeding in this regard. What we urge you, though, is that the story of Eskom is linked to a larger story, a story of not just the criminalization of the state, not just what we call a silent coup, not just a story of criminality, but a story of criminality underpinned by a political conviction which we need to tackle head on. Now, this is why it's so important that this process is happening in a parliamentary forum. At the heart of the circumstances and the events at Transnet, at the heart of the circumstances and events at Eskom, and more broadly, is a political conviction that our constitution is somehow an obstacle to real economic transformation in South Africa. It is that conviction which we argue needs to be tackled head on. The conviction is incorrect. The conviction is false. The Constitution is a progressive document. It comes out of a progressive process, a progressive transition. It provides the basis for all sorts of quite important and fundamental changes to the nature of our society and to our economy. It must not be allowed that this idea of the Constitution as a reactionary or conservative document becomes deeply embedded or ingrained in how we think about South Africa. So what we urge you then going forward as a committee, practically around ESCOM, there are several areas which we urge you to focus on. Of course, the nuclear deal, the question of guarantees and how they are and how they are awarded, the amount of those guarantees, which has been discussed earlier. We urge you to pay attention to the coal contracts, to probe very vigorously around those coal contracts. The story of Trillium is a very, very important one. We urge you to look at the way in which state-owned enterprises, and in particular ESCOM, is structured in terms from its governance point of view, the relationship to the shareholder, to the structure of boards and the relationship to the CEO. So we urge you to focus on the details and probe on the details of ESCOM. But we also ask you to keep in mind and to probe all the time that this is happening within the context of a general shift to illegality and criminality, which is justified and made sense of in terms of this idea that somehow our constitution is an obstacle to change. I think this process is part of a broader process within South Africa, and if successful, I think we are able to turn the ship in South Africa, to reestablish the principles and confirmation, reaffirm our commitment to our constitution and to our democracy. To correct the behavior of the state enterprises, and also to relaunch and reestablish a project of state building in South Africa, to reaffirm the importance of key state institutions and the importance of public servants in South Africa. I thank you.
Thank you very much for the presentations. I think all presentations were clear to us, and all presentation have provided us with the necessary information that we wanted. We could read it, but we saw it befitting that if it is presented, you are able to elaborate on what you have put on the paper. As a committee, that's that elaboration that we were looking for. That's that information that we wanted to get. By the indication from the committee members, I would give you 5 minutes break. Everybody, just to stretch and come back. 5 minutes from now.
I'm staying for a while.
All right.
I just don't know when this is going to end.
I'll give it to
Oh, I'll just stay for another 3 hours.
Okay.
This one's really long.
Yeah.
So, if they continue to have meetings in this room, what are you going to do?
I'm going to go and plug in up the top there. This thing just, battery's not very good. And if I don't plug in,
Yeah.
no worry.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm telling you that
honorable people that are inside this chamber, the 5 minutes is over. I'm the only person who did not stretch his leg. Can we reconvene, please? We are in a very tight situation because our time now is in 12:15. 1 o'clock we will have our lunch, but I will ask the people who are bringing the lunch to bring it inside so that we grab and sit down. Grab and sit down. It will also take 5 minutes for grabbing, and then you sit down with your whatever you have grabbed. No. Thank you very much, and thank you for the presentations again that are before us or that have been presented for us. I just want to caution the members, especially the members of parliament that are in this committee. We have not started with the inquiry yet. We have potential witnesses in our inquiry list. And the SACC, I don't think, is one of our potential witnesses. And the outer and the researchers or the academias are not part of our, but they are part of giving us the information that we think is necessary for us. I'm going to open now for members to ask questions to seek clarity from whatever presentation. I wanted to ask to be logic. If we can start with the first presentation, if it's possible, and then you go from one from the first presentation, and then you go through. I'm not sure if that will work well for you. Come, Honorable Ngo.
I want to make a proposal, Chair, if the committee does agree. Allow us to ask questions wherever. Each team will take the questions that are preferred to serve, so that when they respond, close.
Thank you, Honorable Ngugubele. You'll be the first one to ask questions. I saw your hand. Honorable Swart, Honorable Luyenge, Honorable Mainir, Honorable Gordon, Honorable Singh, Honorable Shivambo, Honorable Tsedi, in that order. I did not give you numbers. I called you by your name. Have to understand. And
Chair, can we just have guidance as to how many questions you can put? Will there be a second round? Or maybe we should limit us to 2 minutes or something each.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. And we have different rounds. Otherwise, should we just...
No, but the members have proposed that I must leave them to talk.
Yeah, let us talk.
That's what I am given here. Yeah.
We're not in a hurry. It's not like Parliament is in session now. So.
Yeah.
Let's go for it.
But remember, we have not started with the inquiry. That should be clear. In the order that I called your names. Thank you very much, Honorable Gouben.
Thank you, Chair. I think I must express my gratitude to the initiative to call the three institutions or bodies to sort of widen our intelligence with regard to creating say good, to start on a sound footing. It comes across as very useful. Somebody might say some of the documents are already in the public arena, but the interaction deals with issues differently than you would have been reading on your own. And I like the fact that they've been very straightforward, clear, and candid, all of them. I just wanted to say one remark first to the Reverend, to the Bishop. To ask the question of the church is unquestionable. History speaks for itself. I agree with you that if either you are innocently ignorant or you are criminal, to be confused about that rule, I do concur with you. It would be very useful as a general statement that the economic impact of this development is well articulated in specific terms. Opportunities lost in terms of jobs and all those kinds. I'm trying to say more work becomes critical. Again, the other issue that I'm very interested in, Chair, is Mr. Blom. I was not sure that's Blom. I remember when I was working in the mining industry, there was Blom. When I worked underground, he was a very cruel chap, not you. What I'm interested in is the narrative of 2005. I think I want to request, through your leadership, Chair, that that narrative of a 93 billion proposal and all other inexplicable escalations, if it can be written down in a sequenced form and with clear concepts. Remember, he speaks about Ekusile and all these power stations and escalation. I find it a very, very interesting narrative. If it can be sequenced, contrasted or juxtaposed, so that you are able to, in a matrix of kind, have a sense of where the contradictions are. A very fundamental issue, especially when he mentioned the issue of what he would refer to as a price electricity increase. I found it very, very useful. And the other critical issue is what has been said around the betrayal. What I'm curious to find out for clarity purposes, you had you said there was a Mbeki era where elite, small elite emerged, vulnerable middle class, and a huge exclusion of many. And you said that then radical language, which grows together with extra-legalism, extra-judiciarism, extra-constitutionalism. In other words, some anarchical type of development. What I want to know from you, is that a mere coincidence, or is it because the policy proposals that are coinciding with that do deliberately allow that? I thought I'm interested in that. And again, on the issue of you say, this is my last point. You spoke about illegality, criminality, behind it, political conviction. Are we saying the political conviction emerges out of illegality, or the illegality is as a result of a political conviction? Otherwise, I'm convinced that a lot of reading, especially after presentation, will be more useful. Thank you.
Honorable Flynn.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for the presentations. I would like to start with the South African Council of Churches and thank you for church that is arising and the voice that is arising in society. And I commend you and I encourage you to not listen to any people that should say that the church has not got a voice. Our courts have upheld that, and it is a critical time for the church in South Africa, and believers, myself as a believer, for you to start speaking out at this time. Because we know that corruption affects us all deeply and affects the poor. And so I want to thank you for the strong stance you've taken. When I engaged in the presidential budget vote, I read from Habakkuk. Bishop, you read from Habakkuk. I read a scripture about plundering and looting that is taking place and how the nation cried out then. The nation is crying out now. How much longer will it continue? And I believe today we start to address the issues of justice and unrighteousness. And I want to commend, Chairperson, you and the committee, that this is the beginning of a process of accountability of justice and righteousness in our nation, starting today. And myself, as a long-serving member of Parliament, commit myself to this process. I serve on the Justice Committee. We know that justice and righteousness is the throne, is the cornerstone of the throne of God. And so it is key for us today to start holding people accountable and say enough is enough. We had 1 million people that prayed together in Bloemfontein for godly intervention. What we see today, you being here, is an answer to prayers. And I would encourage believers throughout and anyone, citizens in South Africa, to start writing to this committee with submissions. Chair, I'm sure we'll discuss that later. But it's a key part. But what I wanted to ask you, as you pray and as you take action in elevating the situation and elevating the evidence, yes, you have indicated that some of the whistleblowers have given evidence. But the additional aspect that you bring is the levels, and this might not be a focus of this portfolio committee, but for me as a parliamentarian, it's important, is the degree of corruption at provincial and local government level as well. And so we need as MPs to have that information. And whilst it is given to you in a confidential setting as clergymen, I would urge you to encourage those people as well to come forward and to lay charges and to take a stance for justice and righteousness. I ask you, where are you taking the process further? You being here, I would urge you to monitor this process as well as the church. Like Nathan the prophet monitored what King David did and held him accountable. The church voice is very important at this stage. So if you could respond to that, where to from now, from the church side, beyond the report, beyond your engagement with the public protector, but particularly on this Eskom issue. Alta, I'd like to also commend you for the work that you've done. The affidavit that you have furnished and that was on the website where you laid the charges is crucial for us, because when we start engaging in this process, it will be done under oath. Witnesses that will come here will give evidence under oath. So what you've already said, I saw last night the affidavit that you filed in the lodging of your criminal actions with all the annexures. That has weight. It has a lot of weight. And so I would ask you also to monitor this process and assist us with, and particularly Mr. Blom, with the expert evidence that you've got having served at Eskom. We're going to need that evidence, and hopefully, Chair, we can engage your expertise and other experts from ATA as we go forward. But what was particularly concerning to me was that issue of that, firstly, two issues which you raised, and that was this hidden checkbook or someone who's got the golden key. I'd like you to further explain that. How is that possible, where you've got IT, you've got SAP processes that you said are very robust? How is it possible that these funds seem to be going and being diverted corruptly? Secondly, the issue of that guarantee. I was startled when I heard the admission made at the Eskom financial statements of this guarantee. I've never, as a lawyer and with an economic background, I've never heard of anything like that, where a state-owned enterprise gives a guarantee for one company to buy another company. But as Mr. Gordon says, we are connecting the dots now. We are connecting the dots. So all this information.
information, Chair, as we're going forward, will be put to witnesses' court. And it's going to be very interesting to see how they respond. But I'd like you as well just to unpack that a little more, because obviously as you connect the dots, you can see the 2.1 billion that was required to purchase the Optimum mines, and then the coal that was moved across is very suspect. It's in the public domain. But again, I want to ask you, you've now laid criminal action, you've laid criminal charges, but if, as is suspected, that even our law enforcement agencies, as Mr. Chipkin pointed out, are captured themselves, we are doing this inquiry. But my greatest concern, and as I've raised it already with the Deputy President, and my leader, Reverend Meshwe, raised it with President Zuma, there is nothing to prevent criminal prosecution taking place now. There is compelling evidence. And so whilst we are going forward with this process, we know funds are leaving the country at an alarming rate. You've laid charges. What is your next step going to be should you find that your charges are not being investigated? Would you, like Prasa, was forced to take the Hawks and the NPA to court after 2 years of non-investigation? Mr. Chipkin, thank you for your presentation, your academic research. And again, as a long-standing member of Parliament, I'm alarmed. I've never heard of anything like this situation. And whilst we've suspected that, we've read your reports, we've seen the reports, but the fact that we've got a whole constitutional democracy is under threat by a shadow state, that what you state and what you allege, that even the majority party, the ANC, has been sidelined, must be a great concern to every citizen in South Africa. And so I want to thank you as well for your presentation, that it's not only focused on a no-confidence debate in President Zuma on the 8th of August, that goes far deeper than that. And it's time for every right-thinking and South African and that wants justice and righteousness to prevail to take a stand now. So I want to commend civil society for this. And I wanted to just ask you to unpack more the evidence that you've garnered in your research, and what are you going to do with that evidence? Yes, you've asked us, and we'll be engaging as parliamentarians, but you, in your own right, at the end of the day, we've still got the rule of law. We've still got independent courts. Are you going to further litigate in any way to ensure that this looting and corruption comes to an end? Thank you, Chairperson.
If I have followed what you have asked for, I would have cut you by now, you see. Let's leave it into open democracy.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me also first join the other colleagues who have just spoken before me in singing the ululation songs for the inputs that have been made by the three organizations. And also appreciate, Chairperson, all your endeavors to find us where we are in this process. The South African Council of Churches, Chair, I think Honorable Kumbuwale has said, it's a mouthful of what he has said, to say they should not be apologetic in doing their work. And in fact, it's not their work, it's God's work. The issues that are real as against the issues that are ideal. The real situation versus what is supposed to be is very critical. And you have that obligation as the church to lead people to do the right thing and to promote morals. I also commend the collaboration between these organizations, because there is chronology, there is logic in what they are saying, and that is why we are not going to waste time, because what they are saying is speaking to what the other was saying. And around all what they are saying, even in the media, everywhere, there are prominent names, there are prominent individuals and institutions and companies. So we are not going to shoot in the dark, because the information, people cannot repeat to say one and the same thing at irregular times, and then you say those people are wrong or they are promoting a particular agenda. So it is good, Mfundisi, that you are in this collaboration with other civil society organizations, because this is attested and confirmed by the Bible in the Proverbs 13 verse 20. It says, and I quote, "He who walks with wise men becomes wise." And it continues to say, "A companion of fools shall be destroyed." I close quote. Chairperson, we cannot in any way blame the legacy of the past, much as we cannot forget what the legacy of the past has done to all of us. But it cannot be a truant mechanism of us to derail our focus, fail the people of the country in favor of our own as individuals and groups. I want to also repeat and agree on the notion that says, yes, there might be political kind of arrangements that are made by people, but I want to put my neck on the block and say, there is no political party which will ever take a decision that let us loot state resources, never. There will never be a conference of any political party that will resolve on the promotion of anarchy, as we see. Individual behavior and conduct must be separated from the organizational conduct and the organizational obligation. We must be able to say what Kungubele is doing. He's doing his own thing. He is not doing what he has been sent by the ANC to do. Chairperson, this looting of state resources is not something that we must not be fighting against just because we know the people concerned or we respect the people's names who are called. It doesn't matter whether you are my father or mother. If you do wrong, I must be able to say so. Much as when you are doing the right thing, we must be able to give a pat on the shoulder and say, even to our children, well done, my son or daughter, so that you can be understood when you say you are not doing right. To outer chairperson, is just one which that says, in fact, it's a question maybe. Have you checked the outer, the processes as they are entailed in the constitution as well as the recruitment processes and policies of government, in the recruitment strategies that are being used and they are questionable to you and the general public? Because what we have heard here, you know, it says to me, Chairperson, we must ask ourselves as to where are we? Are we still in the government that was donated to us by the spilling of the blood of Chris Anis, of the death of our heroes and heroines, Odadu Mandela, Odadu Luthuli, Odadu Tambo, Omamu Sisulu, Odadu Sisulu? Are we still there? So if the answer is positive, then we need to recheck as to who are we? Lastly, Chair, I want to commend the sterling job that has been done by the three organizations and say to suggest, Chair, that we must not, in pursuance of of this process of the inquiry, if we feel like calling any of them to give evidence in our inquiry to justify, because you know what we are going to do, the most important and very critical aspects are coming here in one form or the other. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, Chair. I'd like to address my question to Professor Ivor Chipkin. I want to deal with the narrative which you cast in your presentation, which, if I'm not mistaken, goes something like this. At the center of the rot is what you call a political project. And at the center of that political project is what you referred to as a power elite. And in your document, you referred to as the Zuma-centered power elite, which emerges after what you call the Polokwane moment in 2007. That seems to be the narrative that you cast. How then do you explain Chancellor House, which was formed by the ANC in 2003, and as Outer mentioned, entered into what appears to be a corrupt, or was part of a corrupt contract with Hitachi Africa in 2007, which predates the Polokwane moment. It seems to me that Chancellor House is one of the inconvenient dots which seems to have not been included in your narrative.
Honorable Gordon.
Thank you, Chair. And let me firstly thank you for your leadership in getting us to this point, and hope beyond this point as well. And thank the three organizations and their representatives for what I think whoever is watching is a very interesting start to this inquiry into ESKOM. The organizations before us, Chair, also demonstrate that we have a vibrant democracy, that there are still people who can observe the truth, record the truth, and speak the truth. And that bodes well, I think, for our future. And there are people of this sort both within political parties and outside of political parties as well, which is gratifying. Equally important is the fact, Chair, that we have the Parliament of South Africa embedded in our Constitution, which is taking this initiative, which is an initiative about accountability. And the more Parliament does this, the greater the respect we will have of the South African population, who know that corruption is an important feature that is pervading our country at this point in time. Let me firstly compliment the SACC and Mfundisi Mpulwana for the initiative they took to set up the unburdening panel. I think in his presentation he says very appropriately why this panel was necessary. I won't repeat that. But the question that I would seek his guidance on is whether greed and pursuance of benefits for oneself has reached a point where it's infecting our whole population? Or can we proudly say that the majority of South Africans are still good, honest people, and I certainly think they are. But how are we going to actually then guide South Africans from a spiritual point of view in making sure that our ethics don't decline any further, and that we uphold the values that my colleague, Dr. Luyenge, was talking about a moment ago. Secondly, have we reached a point of impunity as far as those that are directly involved or not so directly involved in this process? In other words, have we reached a point, and all three organizations can respond to this, where the don't care factor, which some think has reached proportions where it allows allows people involved in these activities to act with virtual impunity. In other words, you can't catch me, or there was this movie called Catch Me If You Can, some of you might have seen it, but until you catch me, I carry on and make sure that the spoils are in various accounts all over the world. But worse still for us as a country is this don't care attitude. I don't care about the consequences for the country, its polity and its economy of your kind of activities. To Professor Chipkin more directly, I mean, you might want to look at the concept of deviant globalization, which basically describes how criminality piggybacks on so-called good globalization, and in fact uses the facilities of good globalization. For example, rapid flow of finances across the world. So you can now do money laundering much faster today than you ever did it before. And that piggybacking phenomenon, is that what we've seen in what you've described as the focus on procurement, which is well-intended, but then gets abused for the wrong purposes because the constraints are, in fact, not in place. Second question is, what are the implications for state capability? You said that our focus needs to be on, if you like, restoring state capability. But once an institution is messed up, if I can put it plainly, how long does it take to recover? It takes a long time to build institutions, as we know from our own experience. It can take 10 years to build an institution. It can take 3 to 6 months if you put the right people in the top three positions in an organization. And I think we had that explanation from Mr. Blom as well. What is the recovery time of such a damage that is done? And then part of your slide was this broker network in action. Here you use the example of Transnet. Can you just explain the role of the different, not the individuals necessarily, but the types of people, the so-called brokers and patrons and middlemen, I'm sure there's middle women somewhere as well. How do they all connect to each other? What exactly is the role that each of them actually plays in this regard? But both to Auta and yourself, and this is where the SACC can also play an important moral role. What are we learning about the role of professionals in all of these investigations? And professional, by that I mean accountants, lawyers, consulting firms. You've mentioned some of them in passing. But what's the message to them in terms of their professional ethics? What's the message to them in terms of the moral code that they should actually follow? And what are your observations in terms of levels of inverted commas complicity, either wittingly or unwittingly, either actively or passively, in each of these things that have been going on? Equally to Auta, which has been at the forefront of laying charges and so on, what's our experience? And the others might want to comment on this as well, with our law enforcement agencies, Chair. You can have as many research documents and papers prepared and so on. Are we going to see consequences in terms of investigations and prosecutions as we actually go forward in this regard? And then lastly, Chairperson, what would each of the bodies, and in particular the SACC, have a message to the South African public arising from their experiences in what is going on, particularly in regard to the damage to political ethics, the damage to our economy? We haven't talked too much about that. One of you might actually want to do that. What's the economic damage? Jobs, investment, confidence, trust, growth of businesses, the monopolizing of billions of rands in small circles rather than being spread amongst many, many economic role players who could be developing small and medium-sized businesses instead of just feeding a couple of hungry mouths, so to speak. So what's our message to the South African public? Thank you very much.
Honorable Singh.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson, and good day, colleagues. Firstly, I want to associate myself for the remarks by my other colleagues in thanking the three organizations for being here. And I know, Chairperson, initially you said, you know, you're sorry that you called us during constituency period, but I think it's been a very, very worthwhile exercise because it's just giving us more ideas and more to focus on as we move forward. So well done for calling this meeting today. I just want to pick up, Chair, on where Honorable Gordon left and get the view of the organizations, because as we continue with this inquisition into ESCOM, we may find that what we discover will be like a Sunday school picnic if we have to look at what is happening in other government departments and state-owned organizations where, you know, I liked what the Secretary General of the ANC said at a meeting in the Eastern Cape. He said, "Aluta continua," and not the meaning of Aluta as we know it. The struggle continues, but looting continues. And I think he put it very, very well when he said Aluta continua. So, you know, we have this inquisition, we get to the bottom of things, but then, allied to what Honorable Gordon said, what is your view on how we act on them? Presidents have been put behind bars in other countries for corrupt activities. Here in South Africa, we've got very few examples, I'm not talking about the president, but very few examples of government officials or people involved in parastatals that have been put behind bars for corruption. So what is your general view on that as the three organizations? That's my first one. The second one, Chairperson, is the State of Capture report. I mean, we as parliamentarians are concerned that very little is being done to deal with the report, to take it on review. What is your view on the State of Capture report and the possible dragging of heels in ensuring that the remedial action that has been prescribed by the public prosecutor are put into action? Do you have a view on that? And then another concern what we have is that in your investigations, I'm sure there are certain officials or people that you may have picked out as being the common denominator where corruption is involved. Some of them are still employed by ESCOM, for example. What is your view, because I have a view, that we should ask for the suspension of some of these officials whilst our investigation continues? Because you can't have people who are accused of certain corrupt activities being right in the heart of where they could manipulate things. And then lastly, Chairperson, through you, thank you very much, is the whole issue of, in one of your presentations, you say how the law appears to have been used in favor of the Guptas. Now, it's an assertion, it's an aversion that you are making. Maybe at some stage, I think it's an outer document, you can give us more information, because anybody who is flagrantly disregarding the law or breaking the law should be put behind bars in terms of existing law. So maybe more information in that regard. Thank you, Chairperson.
Honorable Sedi.
Thank you, Chair. Let me join my colleagues in appreciating the three presentations. And I think what I most like about the presentation, Chair, is that in most instances there are suggestions in terms of how Parliament can take some of these issues forward. I think that's what I like the most. Few issues, Chair, that I'll need to be clarified on. Mr. Bloch, I missed that part while you were talking about the service. For how long have you been with ESCOM at some stage? I missed that part. I would appreciate if you can just try and refresh my mind in that regard. Of course, we might need information in terms of the cases that we're talking about. Those that have been referred to the law enforcement agencies, we might need that kind of information. From the South African Council of Churches, I understand you to be saying you as well encountered cases where people were pressurized to divert funds for other activities, rigging of tender processes and all this. What I could not get was, what is it that you have done in that respect, where you came across evidence of cases where the tender processes were floated, like you have mentioned. Going back to OTA, this unfair tariff increase that you spoke about earlier, I'm interested in knowing what has been the attitude of NESA in that regard. If that analysis does take into consideration us and then NESA's views or inputs in that regard. The last one is just a comment that, of course, we might need documentary proof in terms of some of the issues that you've been raising here. Very helpful to the work that we are going to be undertaking. Thanks, Chair.
Honorable Shivam.
No, thank you very much, Chair. I want to associate myself with the biblical quote that was given earlier by Honorable Liang that says that he who walketh with the wise men shall be wise. But a companion of fools shall be destroyed. I think that as part of the durable and long-lasting solutions, we might need to destroy fools. You know, maybe we must start on the 8th of August. We'll see how we're going to handle that. So that we deal with those issues. Now I appreciate all the three submissions that have been made here. And the Honorable Member who spoke now says that there must be documentary evidence. I know that there have been lots of documents that were brought by OUTA. So they were given to Chief Whips. I'm sure that the Chief Whip of the ANC might be having these documents that corroborate everything else that they had said in terms of people that got to receive payments and were entertained by the Guptas and all of those related people. But I think that one thing that perhaps we should say as this committee is that we believe what the South African Council of Churches said here. And I don't think that a Council of Churches would come to with figments of their own imaginations and present misleading information. But also we believe the evidence-based submissions and presentation of OUTA, and we also associate with the social scientific research outcomes of PARI, as presented by Professor Ivo Chipkin. And I think that the key issues that arise out of all the reports is that South Africa is currently experiencing massive, systematic, callous, and rapacious looting of state-owned companies. This looting of resources in magnitudes that have never been seen anywhere. Perhaps maybe compared to what Mobutu Sese Seko did in Zaire. Perhaps compared to what Idi Amin did in Uganda. Perhaps compared to what Mbasogo is doing currently in Equatorial Guinea. I think that is the crisis that we are facing of rapacious looting of state resources in huge magnitudes never seen before. But also there seem to be some collaboration by some of these multinational companies, the SAP and McKinsey, and then they are bowing to the dictates of Trillion Capital, which is a criminal organization. Trillion is a criminal entity that is used to siphon off money from state-owned companies, particularly Transnet and Eskom. It's one of the things that we're dealing with in terms of all of those issues, that Trillion is being paid money for nothing. So another thing just presses a button to transfer hundreds of millions to a company that did nothing. absolutely nothing. 500 million rands. First 30 million rand, and then later on 495. That is what is happening where money that is supposed to deal with electrification is being transferred to the private accounts of a trillion capital. It's one of the things that must be looked into and looted as part of that. But also, we must not ignore the fact that there are political protagonists in all these phenomena. We won't be able to resolve this if we do not call these political protagonists by name. That the president of the ANC is at the center of this crisis of looting of our state-owned companies. So Mr. Jacob Zuma is at the center of the looting of state-owned companies by the Gupta-linked criminal syndicate and mafia. And that must be said like that. And he utilizes the Malusi Gigabas and all of them to run around in the project of looting state-owned companies. And I agree with the observation that when the looting was intensifying, there was then a parallel process to weaken the institutions or to even capture the institutions that would hold the looters accountable. Parallel the institutions in the criminal justice system. How many cases have we opened? Outer CASAC has opened so many cases. The EFF has opened so many cases. I know the DA has opened so many criminal cases with hardcore evidence. And the police are investigating. I know because in the criminal case which we opened in the Rosebank police station, the police came to say that there is a case to pursue. There's a case who can arrest people, but the NPA is not coming to the party to concur, like for concurrence that once you have arrested, we're going to prosecute these people. It looks like the National Prosecution's Authority offices are closed. We don't know what's happening to Sean Abraham. Like, the cases are there. Like, they actually illustrate the police that this is decidedly illegal. But there is nothing that is happening at the NDPP level because Sean Abraham seems to be part of the looting band as well. Closing both eyes on the massive looting resources in a huge way. But I'm worried, Chair, that it looks like also from a technical point of view, Parliament is also incapacitated. Like, that is why you're saying we must go and ask Advocate Venara to come and form part of this process. I mean, Parliament is supposed to be having lawyers of its own, it's supposed to have advocates, it's supposed to have senior counsels who are in the full employ of the institution itself. Now, Advocate Venera works in the office of institutions that support democracy and everything else. They're engaged in their own program because I know when we were in the programming committee, they came to say that they are busy trying to implement the recommendations on the review of Chapter 9 institutions. Because he's one of the two advocates that are employed by Parliament, possibly. Only two advocates for an institution that is supposed to oversee so many government departments and over 150 state-owned companies and entities. So we should make that plea that you started with, that when we start the process of investigation, we should request Parliament to resource this inquiry. This process must be properly resourced. And Chair, I think that perhaps we could source a resident advice of senior counsel who are not in the employ of Parliament, who can come and advise Parliament. I know when there was a referral back of the Financial Services Regulatory Bill by the President, Parliament was able to source the services of Advocate Gantlett, and then the President got Advocate Simenya, and the Standing Committee on Finance got another advocate as well, I think Badland, to advise on the whole legislation. So I don't think that will be off the mark if, as a committee, we could source resident advocates who are going to be advising in the whole inquest process, and then we can then be able to detect the issues that must be taken up for criminal prosecution. We'll have to ultimately refer some of the cases for criminal prosecutions. But also I would think that part of the things that we should consider is that when we convene people to come and give evidence here and testimony, we must not forget the politicians behind it. That is Mr. Jacob Zuma and Manus Kigawa, they must come and account here as to some of the decisions that they've taken that have led to the crisis that we're facing now. But I think that the most worrying reality, which I want to close with, is some of the people that are being spoken about where there's lots of evidence of their wrongdoing now are still in office. I'm not saying he's still a CFO of Eskom. And in the press conference, he says that I'm still going to write a tell-all document. It doesn't deny that there's everything wrong that he has done. He's still there. Richard Sleke is still the Director General of Public Enterprises. Iqbal Sharma is still in the board of Transnet. Dan Macha is still the chairperson of DINEL. These are Gupta ground forces. The ground forces of the Guptas that are busy looting our state resources, we're talking here, and they're still in the system. We need to find a different mechanism. Perhaps the ministry must be appraised of some of these realities. That I don't think that any rational person could dispute the evidence that has been presented to us here in terms of the wrongdoing on the part of the people that we're talking about. There has to be action in terms of what should happen so that we also at least achieve something. We must at least stop it for now, and then we'll then attend to the ones that have stolen, because all of them must bring back the monies that they've stolen. All the monies that have been stolen must be brought back. It must be paid back. That must be the intention, that no one must ever steal money in South Africa and then they go without having to pay it back. We're a parliament that is mandated to collectively oversee the expenditure of our resources. Our economy is going backward now in terms of growth. We need to cut resources that are needed to help as many people as possible. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, honorable members, for your questions. I have only one question that, or a concern that has been raised here. On the 7 points that Bishop, my apologies for calling you a reverend. My humble apologies. My humble apologies. I am told that you are a bishop. I also know that they call you Bishop Mbumlwana. The issue that was raised on your 7 points in saying there is an undermining effort to weaken the government of South Africa. You have pointed them here on your presentation. Do you think people that we employ as government are people that are incapacitated, especially when we talk about the SOEs, because SOEs are supposed to be developing the economy of the country. They are in the center of developing the country. But do you have a suggestion, maybe? Maybe the suggestion will form part of our recommendations after the inquiry that you can make for us. Because I am asking this question because when we were presented by Mr. Molefe in the Committee of Public Enterprise, when he was taken from Transnet to Eskom, there was this crisis of load shedding then, because that's what Eskom comes with when they come with us. There was this problem of load shedding every day that was happening. And apparently he has expertise of turning the tide. So, as Mr. Brian Molefe, I'm talking about Mr. Brian Molefe. That was what was presented to us because he was seen as a person who can reverse the issue of plunging the country into a total blackout. So the expertise that was presented to us, we as a country for that matter, we took it very serious because when he came in, it really changed something because we moved from load shedding to electricity that was flowing. We don't know what was behind that as a committee and as an ordinary South African. So do you think that there was something behind employing, as you have presented, there was something behind employing Brian Molefe and removing what's the other gentleman, Tshidiso Maduna, then, because when you speak, all three organizations that have spoken, you spoke about the way the worm is moving. I would take it, it's going deeper and deeper and deeper. If then that is the case, Do you have maybe something that you can say to us that no, this has happened this way, not the way that it has been presented into the committee in our committee meeting. Mr. Blom, just a concern. I think one of the members raised the issue of money that was budgeted for in the building of Mudupi and the money that went beyond. And you spoke about the money that has been the key, that somebody is holding a key. I would also wish that you can explain that phenomenon to us, so that we really understand, and when we get to into our inquiry, we will really get deeper to the information that you have given us. Thank you very much. Before the organizations respond, can we have a 30-minute break of lunch so that after that they come and respond, and then we conclude the meeting?
Can I raise one question, Chair, with your permission? We missed out two words in all of our questions. Oh. What's the role of Belle Pottinger as you go to lunch?
Okay, Honorable Nobant, sorry. The last time I saw you were seated there, that's why I did not see you. And okay, you know you have to.
Thank you, Chair. Mine is on. I would also like to thank the presentations that were given today. And on the SACC, one would say when the church speaks, the nation listens. And we take it that as when the church speaks, it's God speaking. So it is upon us to listen to what God is saying. On the OWATA report, I wanted to ask Mr. Bloom if he can clarify this
bypassing of the SA subsystem, and whether what does this mean for Eskom and any other company using the same system going forward. My last question is on that the report is from 2005. Does this mean there's a possibility that this might have been going on before 2005? Because everything that we presented starts from 2005. Is there a possibility that this money missing, laundering, looting, whatever, has been going on before then? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. The response we are going to get after lunch, can we then break for lunch? We will be back at 10 to 2.
Tell me that you can.